You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, November 13th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a guest rogue this evening, Devin Bray. Devin, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Good evening.
So, Devin, what path, what long and twisty road brought you to be a guest rogue on our show this evening?
Well, it is kind of a long and twisty road. It begins with me becoming a magician at age 7.
All right, it's a little bit farther back than I intended, but go ahead.
Well, believe me, it's worth it. It's worth it. I became a magician at a very young age, became familiar with James Randi. That became my introduction to critical thinking, which then led me to you guys and eventually into philosophy. And so I'm with you guys tonight because I am a professor of philosophy at the University of Nevada, Reno. I teach critical thinking and I teach core humanities. And you guys have been very influential to my trajectory towards naturalistic and scientific thinking. So thank you for
great.
That.
That's so cool.
So what's your specialty as a philosopher?
I try to be pretty broadly read. Philosophy can be very contentious with lots of camps. I try not to take sides in those big camps battles like continental versus analytical. I think they both have their place. But I do a lot of my work in philosophy of science, philosophy of cognitive science, and philosophy of critical thinking. So a lot of stuff that overlaps with the interests of you guys here.
That's so cool. And overlaps a lot with like cognitive psychology as well.
Hopefully, yeah, if I'm doing my job well.
Well, to make it clear, so Devin, you're actually a patron of ours.
I am, actually, yeah.
And thank you for that.
Yes. Oh, my God. Thank you so much for your generosity. But the reason why you're here is you have successfully been a patron for 6 months. So you joined us at the Luxotic level specifically so you could be on the show, right?
That's right. Yeah, I really wanted to talk to you guys.
I love that. Oh, that's so cool.
Well, there are so many times that you guys are covering science topics on this show, and I've wanted to jump in and say something. Now I finally get an opportunity to do it.
Oh, you could have done it all the while, but we just wouldn't have heard you.
Yeah, people do that. People do talk back to their whatever, their radio or their...
Or yell at it. Or
oh, yeah, I do that all the time. It's part of the reason I'm really bad at listening to podcasts, because I'm like, why aren't you answering me?
I do it too. Sometimes I just put myself on mute and curse all you guys out.
Exactly.
Sometimes you forget to put us on mute.
That's also true.
So Devin, let me ask you a simple question to get us started.
Sure.
Does free will exist?
Oh boy.
That is, I think, one of the most difficult questions facing us in the philosophy of cognitive science right now. And part of what I'm interested in is whether or not certain versions of free will are even physically possible. Mm. The answer as of right now is I'm not sure, but I think that really hardcore determinists who say that science has already shown that free will can't possibly exist are a little overzealous. Like Daniel Dennett, I'm sympathetic, also philosopher of cognitive science, Daniel Dennett. I'm sympathetic to a position called compatibilism, where it could be the case that we have something like free will, even if we are deterministic robots. Mm-hmm. That sounds crazy to most people at first, but
yeah.
I think it's a defensive position.
I'm glad there's a little chance of it, though.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like we have free will.
It's the illusion of free will, right?
It's a very compelling illusion.
It's certainly if it is an illusion, then it's a very compelling one, and one that I don't think we have a choice to believe in or not. I don't think that, this is something that Hume said. I know you're a fan of Hume, Steve, mm-hmm. that even if you decide philosophically that you're not going to believe in free will anymore, that doesn't actually compel your behavior in any meaningful way. Mm-hmm. You're still going to go get a drink of water next time that you're thirsty. You're still going to deliberate next time you have to make a decision. So that, the metaphysical argument has no force.
Right.
Are people actually staking a claim that people are essentially deterministic? I mean, wouldn't that kind of fall into the realm of more like something chaotic, something that's inherently unpredictable because of the interplay of all the various variables? Are or they're just so entangled that you'll never be able to make it deterministic.
Can't tease it out.
Well, I mean, that is a perfect path to go down right there, and that's the path that I'm most interested in right now is the application of dynamic systems theory to questions about free will. Now, one thing you might remember about dynamic systems is that they are deterministic at bottom. They're unpredictable, and there are multiple levels of feedback that cause novel behaviors, but there's no indeterminism involved. I find that very tantalizing.
Right.
Ooh, tantalizing. Quite a philosopher word.
But if you compare it to natural systems like the weather, long-term prediction of weather is inherently unpredictable. It's just a fundamental limit.
Oh, yeah.
So I wonder, does that apply to, to the mind brain as well?
I think it very well might. I mean, there are questions about when we're talking, you mentioned the weather, for instance, and when we're talking about a mind, you're never going to be able to isolate all of the variables or get all the values exactly correct at any given time in exactly the same way. So no matter what kind of technology we invent in the future, at least on a neurological level or on the level of A-level chemistry and physics, you're never going to be able to predict what somebody is going to be able to do. But then again, with chemistry, you might not ever be able to discern that two people are performing the tarantella. So there are different levels of analysis that we have to consider when we're looking at these kinds of questions.
And on the other hand, the human brain's not a quantum system, really. I mean, ultimately, it's quantum, but mind may not have any basis in quantum mechanics. So that kind of makes me think that ultimately, maybe there can be some predictability. Because you don't have to worry about the position and momentum of every particle because it's not really based on quantum mechanics. You don't need a quantum. You don't need quantum mechanics to create a mind. So I don't know. I guess I'm all over the place on this one.
It's a confusing topic, but yeah. Trying to disentangle all these different issues is one of my favorite pastimes.
Bob, you have the free will to be confused about all of this, just so you know.
Devin, let me ask you another question. Did the HAL 9000 have free will?
I think that to whatever extent it would be possible for a human being to have free will if they're a deterministic system, then it would be at least possible in principle for a machine to have the same.
Mm. Right. Mm. It's basically the same question. He seemed like he had free will.
Mm-hmm. Probably did.
Did he experience his own existence?
When he killed people, he certainly seemed that way.
He is a fictional character, you guys.
What?
You realize that, right? Devin, guess what dug up in my university digital library?
What is that?
A little something called Potency and Process, a Naturalistic Defense of Mental Causation. Yes, I'm going to read your master's thesis.
Oh, yes, that's my thesis.
Awesome.
That is my best attempt to defend my my own kind of variation on a compatibilist defense of free will. I'm not so sure it works, but it's my best shot as of right now.
Well, that's really cool that you dedicated so much time and effort to doing that. I think that's a really, important endeavor to explore personally, but also really makes these kinds of conversations that much richer.
So what about the HAL 9000?
Yeah, let's get back to my segue.
Let's do it.
Do you know who did the voice for the HAL 9000?
Who? The guy who died.
No. Douglas Rain, who just passed away. That's why we're talking about it.
Aww.
Yeah, Douglas Rain.
Did he sing Daisy?
Canadian actor, mainly in the theater, but his big movie credit was that he did the voice of HAL.
Amazing.
In 2001 and the follow-up, because he had that perfect creepy monotone voice. It was
cold. Yeah. It was so cold, that voice.
And yet, he was the most human character in the movie.
I know.
Yeah.
Right. I know.
That's what they say.
I think that was quite deliberate.
Yeah, by design, I think.
I'm just proud of you, Steve.
But a great job. I mean, it's iconic. Iconic. I mean, something gets imitated so often, right? And it had an impact. It touched something. He hit upon something fundamental, I think, with that character. Because it's the very thing that we're talking about. You're trying to imagine what Hal is thinking and what his motivation is and what he's going to do. And just that unknown, the inability to sort of predict what he's going to do makes him scary. Well, that and the fact that he controlled the whole ship,
Well, that, right.
Yeah. Well, when he started lip reading, right, Evan? That was like the whole...
That was whoa, yeah. That was a moment in that movie. He's 90 years old, Douglas Rain, so he had a good run, but not quite as long as Stan Lee, who died yesterday at age 95. 95. Jeez,
that's a good life. And he was like, you know, doing stuff almost all the way to the end. He was like doing interviews regularly. Yeah.
I was thinking the same. Enviable lifespan.
For
sure.
Yeah.
His celebrity built and built and built more right to the end. Yeah. He had that rare career in which he died more popular than ever in anywhere at any other point of his career.
Oh, that's so true.
So how did he? I wonder how did he die? Did he fall into a vat of chemicals or was he
bombarded with gamma radiation?
Gamma radiation, yeah.
He would have loved that.
Was he bit by a spider?
So I was reading a lot about Stan Lee, and you know a lot of people do credit him with a real renaissance in the comic book industry, which led to a renaissance in modern, blockbuster films. The whole idea of having one comic book hero bleed into another, they exist in the same world, right? And that they interact with each other, different, you know what I mean? Different comic book heroes was all him, from what I understand. And that then the movies of Capital, the Marvel, movie franchises capitalized on that to great effect. That's all Stan Lee.
I also loved how I saw an old interview with him where he was, asked about the science of his different characters, because of course that's become like a subgenre in itself, this sort of meta genre of taking comic book heroes and like analyzing them from a scientific perspective. Powerful is Thor's hammer? Yeah, it's a super fun thing. And somebody was asking him about the science of his characters, and he was saying basically like, I don't know literally anything about science, but I like for things to sound sciencey. And so I tried to integrate all of these like science friendly terms and concepts without actually getting deep into the background. But I think in doing that, he actually opened up an entire field of people who have these, Venn diagram loves of comic books and fantasy and science, and sort of really did inspire a whole generation of science communicators, which is super cool.
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this guy invented or co-wrote characters like Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
But he had multiple famous characters that he was part of the creation of, which is amazing. If you just created Spider-Man, if that was the only thing you did in your life, that would have been profound. But he was there at a time when all of these cool power sets hadn't been used before. So I just think that's fun, to think that he was running wild in that imaginary universe of superherodom and came up with all these wonderful superheroes.
And the conventional wisdom is that what he innovated was really making those heroes human. He gave all of his heroes had a significant flaw or frailty.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like Spider-Man's insecurity or Iron Man swagger
I think he wanted the kids who were reading these books to really identify with these characters and to find strength in them, and that was effective.
Their weakness, they're superheroes, but it's their weakness that makes them such compelling characters.
That's what I mean. Like a little kid is going to identify with the fact that he's insecure, that he's whatever, but through that he's going to see the strength of Spider-Man and find his own inner strength, which is super cool.
And it makes the strength more profound when
especially for those of us who actually look at it with that kind of nuance.
So some people have said, "Oh, no more Stan Lee cameos in Marvel movies," but apparently he
I think it was me.
Yeah, he recorded a lot of those ahead of time, so I don't know. We might have some in the bank.
Oh, that'd be cool. Oh,
that'd be so awesome.
I can so see that being something that he would do.
Yeah. Or like the Hollywood execs who are like, now, how old is he? How many more are we supposed to be making in this particular contract? I'm sure that that had something to do with it.
All right. Well, let's plug on with our show. Carrie, you're going to start us off with a very interesting, what's the word?
So the word is cybernetics. And I know that it's interesting because this is a great word that we actually use on the show, but I don't think we use terribly often. It's definitely a good buzzword, like when you're talking about the turbo encabulator, a cybernetic portion of it is a really, fun buzzword. But let me see here. It was recommended by, Morton Omholt Alver, who said, thanks for a great show. I discovered it just a few months ago. I'm amazed at the quantity and quality of your output. I bought the book. Blah, blah, blah. Super sweet. Thank you, Morton. I suggest cybernetics for What's the Word? I work at the engineering cybernetics department at NTNU in Norway. So my interest in the word is perhaps not a surprise. Okay, so Morton, I'm just going to ask you right now to, like, please give me your feedback, because this is a cursory understanding that I'm going to offer. It's one of the rare words where I'm actually going to start with the etymology, because we know exactly who coined it, and in coining it really gave power to the terminology. Yet, even the terminology has evolved with the times. So it was coined in 1948 by a mathematician here in the United States named Norbert Wiener. He coined it to basically be defined as the theory or study of communication and control. It seems to have Greek roots that have to do with guiding, governing, or steering, kind of steering or piloting a ship, or directing something. And really, that comes down to the fundamental defining features of what cybernetics is: the study of human control functions and of mechanical and electronic systems involving the application of statistical mechanics to communication engineering. That is, I think that's a Merriam-Webster definition, but I found a really good blog post taken from Paul Pangaro, who I think is a pretty early architect in the field. And he helps make the distinction between cybernetics and artificial intelligence, which I think it's often confused for. Mm-hmm. And so he says...
Really? AI?
Yeah. So he says AI and cybernetics are widely misunderstood to be the same thing. However, they differ in many dimensions. For example, AI grew from a desire to make computers smart, whether smart like humans or just smart in some other way. Cybernetics grew from a desire to understand and build systems that can achieve goals, whether complex human goals or just goals like maintaining the temperature of a room under changing conditions. And so when you start to dig into this idea of cybernetics, you see that cybernetics requires feedback, right? The concept mm-hmm. of cybernetics is as old as time. Like, they're natural systems all the time that build and change and require feedback to then iterate and become more focused. So when you look at these roots of the word, things like governing or steering, it really does, I think, paint a good picture of the field of cybernetics as a whole, which is about having a goal and taking action to achieve that goal. Now, granted, we usually think of it as having this strong technological bent to it, and we often think of it in terms of sort of futurism or in terms of AI or robotics. But really, the core of cybernetics is about having a goal-oriented behavior and then iterating and making changes and utilizing feedback to then try and achieve that goal. But even how we define whether or not a goal is achieved is a complicated question when we're talking about computer systems. So it's a fascinating field. And even looking at the bibliography on Paul Pangaro's website, there's actually an article called The Cybernetics of Cybernetics. So yeah, it gets really meta. Mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly enough, Kara, you mentioned that cybernetics, the netics part, has to do with steering. Mm-hmm. That comes from the Greek nautes, which comes from naus for ship. So that also connects into aeronautics and, you know, nautical steering, all that. That's all the same root word.
Absolutely. Cool. Yeah. It's super cool to see how those things grow out of either the original Greek and Latin and then kind of change and stuff. And apparently, there's another word in French, cybernétique, which is actually older, which means the art of governing. And it's, you know, those could have had what we would say maybe in biology is sort of like a convergent evolutionary process or linguistic process to come to those points.
Do you remember that the Terminator was described as a cybernetic organism?
That's right.
Really? Yeah. Oh, because, yeah, that. He was goal-oriented, wasn't he?
Well, I certainly was.
Yeah. That's a good way to describe him.
All right, we're going to move on to some news items. Bob, this one's interesting. The Earth has two hidden moons.
What?
How is that possible?
Where are they?
Well, let's put it this way. Earth officially has two newly documented natural satellites, probably a better way to say that. So Hungarian astronomers and physicists confirmed decades of speculation that Earth has natural satellites at some Lagrange points consisting of essentially diffuse dust particles. As you said, see, this was really interesting and unexpected. I wasn't aware of the speculation that's been going back for years about this, but I'll start with some wacky headlines on this, ranging from wrong, like Earth has three moons. Extra that's it. Earth has three moons, and then extra go. Moons in quotes confirmed after 50 years of speculation. And then the website showed a really cool picture of three moon-like moons, like real, like solid satellites that looked great, but it's so wrong, it's pathetic. Mm-hmm. So that let's see, other ones range to goofy. It said space shocker. Astronomers confirm Earth has two hidden dust bunnies floating around it, which is more accurate than
that's more
straight
accurate
up moons. That's
dust,
more accurate.
Dust bunnies are better.
Yes, better. Aww. But then even better. Dusty pseudo-satellites in orbit alongside our lunar neighbor. So that's really good. So no, they are not moons like any moons you've probably imagined. But I like the term dust moons. That's actually, you know, besides pseudo-satellite, dust moons kind of gets it out there. So this has history to it. Polish astronomer Kazimierz Kordolewski in the 1950s was looking for solid moons. They, you know, he was looking at the Lagrange points around the Earth because he thought it would be like a good place for solid moons to be. Now, Lagrange points, we've mentioned them on the show before. These are points in space between bodies like the Earth-Moon or Earth-Sun where gravity balances out. More accurately, because I'll probably get emails, it's where the gravitational pull of two big masses equals the centripetal force required for a small object to move with them. And there's five of them. For each two-body system, there's about five Lagrange points. But the bottom line, though, is that you can hang out there with minimal effort. It's kind of like a parking lot in space. And it can really come in handy. So Kordolewski obviously didn't find any real moons at these Lagrange points that he looked at, but he did see a brightening. And in 1961 at L4 and L5, he saw some brightening and he suspected what it was, but many astronomers didn't buy it. So it was controversial ever since then. And there it stayed for decades because these clouds of dust are amazingly faint, incredibly faint. So, of course, we were able to eventually science the shit out of this mystery, and it essentially came down to special polarizing filters. It's the polarized light. The light reflects off of the individual cloud particles, become polarized when they reflect off, and then these filters can detect that. And no other optical phenomena will likely explain this. So I think certainty is very, very high at this point. It's pretty much, they're very confident, I'll say.
Bob, now those clouds flavored like butter or popcorn or anything like that?
Close, Jay. They're tiny. First off, the individual particles are a millionth of a meter, a micrometer. So they're really tiny. It's composed, I would say, primarily of asteroid and cometary debris that's been around for as long as our solar system has been around. It's about as far away as the moon, about 250,000 miles, 402,000 kilometers, which is interesting, right? Two clouds, both of them approximately as far away as the moon. And it's a lot bigger than you think, 15 by 10 degrees wide. And so to put that into perspective, that's 30 by 20 lunar disks. Or 9 times wider than the Earth. So this is like, these are really expansive, very, very wide. The other interesting thing is that the particles that comprise these clouds renew themselves. They're not, the particles that are there now were not there millions of years ago. They're kind of continually being swapped out. Because even at a Lagrange point, you've got these minute gravitational tugs, say, you know, from the moon or the Earth, and these little tugs can knock out some of the particles. But then they're replenished by other dust particles that are in the solar system. For example, like a Perseid meteor shower debris could replenish it. But they think that this has been around, you know, still, even though they're kind of transient, these clouds have probably been around since the birth of the Earth-Moon system. So they've been here for quite a while. So the future. So why is this even interesting? Actually, this may become very important in the relative near future. These are the L4 and L5 Lagrange points. I don't know if I mentioned that earlier. That's where these clouds are. So those points can be potential sites for lots of things in the future, like orbiting space probes. In fact, the James Webb Telescope is going to L2. Now, I assume that they've checked that out and there's no, you know, moon dust clouds in there. But it could also they could also be used for transfer stations for missions. And some people are even saying they could be used as places to store pollutants. Hello, who the hell is suggesting that? That's ridiculous. But still, I mean, if you're going to be actually putting probes there or sending people there, you know, before like they go to Mars or even the moon, then you don't want that kind of debris there, that, even though it's pretty diffuse. So that's it. So these aren't moons, but they are natural satellites of sorts. Call them whatever you want. Just don't call them moons, please.
Why would you store toxic waste at a Lagrange point or something like that? Wouldn't you just jettison out into space and let it float?
Yeah, like shoot it to the sun.
Yeah.
You got to get it real far. Seems,
yeah, why would you want it?
The sun's the best garbage dump, though, isn't it? I mean, too bad. It costs so much money to launch, you know, waste into the sun. But, man,
yeah,
once that's cheap, like, yeah, just throw it into the sun.
Yeah. It's what Futurama does 1,000 years from now. They take all the garbage in New Jersey and they hurl it towards the sun.
But don't they have – what was it, the Simpsons or the Futurama that had just a bottomless pit? Oh, that was a Simpsons – Halloween episode, actually.
But yeah, I mean, I think the kind of bottomless pit and the throwing it into the sun analogy is a good one for like basically what we've linguistically sort of primed ourselves to think we're doing when we put something in the garbage, right? Is we just say, oh, just throw it away.
There is no away.
Exactly. So in our minds, we just, well, we don't think about the bad place that it goes. That might as well be the sun or the bottomless pit.
Heck no.
But it's not.
Right. Bob, are the Lagrange points, do they have zero gravity? Or, you know, I'm curious about, like, how big are they? Is there an area where there's, like, almost no gravity?
They're very stable. You would need minimal station keeping. You know, it would take very little, you know, those little jets to make sure you're oriented properly. You would need very little of that. And so that's why they're so fantastic, because you're pretty much going to stay put.
Now, one thing that I found interesting about what you said as well was that these moons are not so much like objects. They're being constantly replenished.
Right.
The particles that make them up are not the same particles that made them up a few years ago.
Or, bigger turnover, maybe 100,000 or 1,000, but whatever. But yeah, the idea is that they're not totally static. But yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't suspect that.
Well, I think that it's interesting partially because it's going to relate to something I want to talk about a little bit later when it comes to objects in general and you know, transient configurations and how that relates to thinghood. So we're going to get real abstract later.
Oh, yeah, that sounds cool.
These you know, dust moons are not really defined by the physical substance there, but more of the location. It's just a place gravitational where dust collects.
It's structure more than it is a specific thing.
It's really the gravity that's defining them.
You could think of a human that way. What was that myth that every 7 years you replace every atom in your body is replaced, which is, only that's partially true. Certain cells like neurons don't really have much turnover, except some of the components on the inside of the cell, I think, probably do. But it made me think of that.
Yeah, the cells themselves change a lot, but they don't multiply so easily.
Yeah, but like your skin, for example, is pretty new.
Oh, yeah.
Turned over there.
Oh, yeah. You're,
it'd be
yeah.
funny if an alien looked at us the way we're looking at these dust moons. There's those humans are so transient. They're not even the same. But it's all about the pattern. It's all about the pattern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of patterns, you guys remember that conversation we had about how you imagine the calendar? Like, do you have a
– Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Gosh. Yeah.
Like the days of the week and the months of the year are sort of physically laid out in some kind of way in your head.
Yep.
Every decade is perpendicular for me.
It turns out neuroscientists are finding out why that is.
What? That's cool.
Yeah.
Do tell.
That's really interesting.
That, in fact, we may think that thinking itself may be based upon visual spatial relationships and may be related to the part of the brain that's responsible for our ability to navigate around our environment.
Makes perfect sense. It relates to, like, you know, the whole memory house strategies.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Or memory palace, if you're...
That's it.
Hannibal Lecter.
Hannibal Lecter, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There was an incredible magician at a SciComm camp this year who did this memory palace thing where he like ripped up a bunch of pages from science magazines from that month and handed them out to people in the audience and could tell them the names of headlines, what the pictures were. In one point, he read an entire ad down to like the promo code, which was just a string of numbers and letters. It was amazing. Like, wow. It was really impressive. And it was all, he said it was all Memory Palace.
Yeah. The stronger you can involve multiple modalities from, you know, visual and auditory, smells, if you can bring those in, then yeah, that's going to bolster your ability to remember that tenfold.
So what the study showed is interesting. So it was a paper putting forth this hypothesis, but and summarizing what evidence there has been that supports it. The idea is that the part of our brain that has been recently examined, this is actually a Nobel Prize in 2014. You have the grid cells and the place cells. Basically, the place cells light up when rodents are in a certain location. And then as they navigate around, then the grid cells light up in a pattern that reflects the way that they're moving around their environment. So this is all just physical navigation in your environment. Well, it turns out that these same cells get light up when you are remembering stuff, right? That it could be that your mental space that is this you is has an analogy to the physical space. So when you're thinking about a mental space, a cognitive space, your brain is using the same wiring as when you're thinking about a physical space.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Analogy, as Douglas Hofstadter likes to say, is the engine of all cognition.
Yeah, that exactly. That also relates to something else that we've talked about before on the show called embodied cognition, where abstract thoughts are generally metaphors for more concrete physical concepts, right? So we talk about an argument being strong or weak, right? An idea, it could be big or beautiful. A thought could be deep. You know, you could be hierarchically above somebody else. We talk about physical characteristics and relationships as metaphors for abstract ideas. But it's possible that that's the way our brain fundamentally operates, that we think this way.
And that your mood could be down, or you could even be crushed at a given time.
And Steve, it's so interesting because I think a core of a lot of like emotion focused psychotherapies, like therapies for people who have like suffered from trauma or abuse, who have dysregulated emotions, like either they're overregulated or underregulated, or for whatever reason they feel very out of touch with what they feel in their body, is to make a connection to your somatic self. Mm-hmm. Like when I feel angry, what is my bodily sensation to that? And the more that you can find that connection, the more you can start listening to your emotions, which is not easy for some people to do.
And so the other idea here is that, which this is now more speculation, but it could be revealed with more animal research, is maybe this is how our brains literally evolved, right? Like we evolved the circuitry that maps to the physical world. And then that circuitry then, as we evolve, gets, you know, repurposed from other things, right? And eventually more and more abstract kind of thinking. So it literally evolved out of, like, abstract thinking evolved out of concrete thinking, which makes sense. So that, you know, very primitive nervous system would, what would it do initially? Not do philosophy out of the gate, right? It's going to just maybe count to two, or know the difference between left and right or up and down. Like just the most basic things are what this processing system is going to do initially. And then it just gets more and more complicated. The ideas get more and more abstract, by which we could literally mean just longer and longer chains of analogy and metaphor to the concrete. But at the core of all of our thinking are these very basic physical concepts.
I'm totally on board.
You like that?
I do. Yeah, I think. And William James said a lot of stuff like this a very long time ago. He, as far as I'm aware, was one of the first in the Anglophone philosophy world to talk about the fact that emotions are rooted in bodily states. That the emotion doesn't come first, and then the bodily state follows. That it goes the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's definitely a complex relationship there, and then I don't think that necessarily this is the only way that we think. You know, when we organize our thinking about things, I think we definitely do that, physically organize our thoughts a lot, but I don't think that's the only way that we do it. But also, this, I think, explains why infographics are so appealing.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Right?
I love those things.
Yeah, you visually organize. I always like to visually organize my information, you know? I also think that there's a lot of neurodiversity, you know, to use that term.
Yeah.
That people think in different ways, because just like everything, there's variability. And occasionally, you know, the neurological variability hits upon novel ways in which different kinds of processing interact with each other, right? So you have like mathematicians who relate numbers to colors or something. You know, it's almost...
Yeah, you've got a synesthesia.
Yeah, almost synesthetic, yeah.
But like, you've got a synesthete who has some sort of like really amazing novel problem-solving thing that like maybe I couldn't ever have because I'm not synesthetic. Or maybe I could learn to adapt that and use it to my advantage. It's cool to see those like nucleation sites.
Because your brain just doesn't process information that way.
Exactly.
It's something that I've wondered about a lot with respect to my own cognition, just because it seems like in my own thinking, it's very non-visual. And I'm not sure whether or not I'm just a particularly non-visual thinker or whether other people are overestimating how visual their phenomenology is. It's very hard to say. Well, but it seems like from some of the evidence, yeah.
Can't see, like they don't have a mind's eye at all.
Right.
And aphantasia.
Yeah, wow, aphantasia, yeah. Ooh. So that's like a, you know, it's probably just like almost anything else from the neuropsychiatric or neuropsychological realm. There's probably a continuum, you know, and some people are really far on one side versus the other. But most of us are kind of hanging out somewhere in the middle.
And if you look at the data, like people who think of themselves as a visual learner or an auditory learner has no effect on their actual ability to learn from any particular medium. So I think that people overestimate how big of a difference it is. I think we all do everything. You know, maybe we might have a preference for one type of interfacing with information. I know I do both. I mean, it just depends on the context and, you know, what I have access to. I like to see things visually arranged, but I also can I'm perfectly happy interacting with information purely linguistically. You know, language is also extremely powerful. Or sometimes I'll tie it to numerical concepts. It just depends. It's very context dependent.
But it is super cool when you talk to people about their experience, let's say, reading a novel.
Yeah.
And that some people literally say the words out loud in their head. Some people can literally watch a visual scene unfold as they're reading. And other people have, you know, different hybridizations of the experience. Some people hear voices of the different characters. Some people only hear it in their own narration. It's interesting that even beyond learning, just interfacing with reality might have different schemas for different people.
Right.
You know, I wonder if a good litmus test would be to find out the way in which people dream. Because I know that my own dreams tend to be very auditory and conceptual, but I very rarely dream in images.
Really? Yeah, but that requires that you can actually remember and then talk about your dreams.
I dream in images. I mean, very dramatic.
Oh, very images. Strong images.
And I very rarely wake up having felt that I dreamed at all. I know I do dream, but it's super rare that I could iterate to you what my dreams are. So
you could affect that to a certain degree, though, Kara. You can.
So, Evan, who is this mad Russian guy?
Oh, he's mad. He's mad, all right.
Like he's angry mad?
Well, I don't know that we would even be talking about the mad Russian today if it weren't for our friends at NBC, the National Broadcasting Corporation. So let me give you a little bit of background before we go into the story of the mad Russian. On June 12, 2017... NBC launched a new experimental video unit called NBC Left Field. And now I'm reading this from their mission statement. They are aimed at understanding human beings through film, technology, and heaps of creativity. It is a global video unit staffed by individuals from more than a half dozen countries, and they use high-gloss video to immerse viewers in the lives of individuals in extraordinary situations around the globe. Emphasis on the word extraordinary. And I've never heard the term high-gloss video before. Is that something I missed at some point?
I've never heard that either.
Sounds like marketing gobbledygook.
Yeah, it kind of is. It's this very modern way of presenting stories, kind of like Vice. You ever seen Vice or Viceland and how they present some of their stuff? It has that.
This shit's not glossy.
Just polished,
well,
I guess.
I'm just saying it has that sort of feel to it. So
I think their stuff looks like DIY and grungy.
They're appealing to a younger crowd, I believe, by doing these sorts
of
things.
Oh, for sure.
All right, let's have a look at NBC's Left Field's most recent offering. Here it is. It's a 5-minute video titled, "Can the Mad Russian Cure Your Addiction?" Question mark.
You know, the rule of thumb is that any headline that has a question in it, the answer is no.
That is a safe bet. A very safe bet. Now,
also, that if you're taking an exam in school and the question says, blah, 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 always leads to blah, 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 the answer is usually false. Usually.
Yeah.
When you're getting your driver's test, if there's a motorcycle in the picture, the answer is the motorcycle.
Oh, or the pedestrian.
Yeah. That's right. That's a good point. But the Mad Russian might be able to cure your addiction. Mm-hmm. Because overcoming addictions can be challenging. But a man in Massachusetts claims that he can manipulate energy with his hands to stop pain and drug or alcohol addiction on the spot. Yes, I snapped my finger there.
Seems legit.
Yes. Yeah. He is nicknamed the Mad Russian. His real name is Yefim Shubentsov. And he claims to have treated over 167,000 people since the 1980s with his unorthodox addiction treatment techniques, which are, as they say,
magic.
Yeah. Not backed by any established science, if you haven't figured that out yet. And so the people at NBC Left Field went to interview him and see what he was all about. What unfolds is a puff piece about him. It's a 5-minute piece, and it's filled with a little bit of interview of him, along with glowing testimonials from his clients, all of whom have one thing in common. They have no idea what he's doing, and all they know is that it worked for them. He was able to use his magic manipulation of energy fields in order for them to kick their habits, no matter what it was. Now, predictably, they interview a doctor from New York University for the last 60 seconds of the segment, and he plays the role of the token skeptic. But he is so wishy-washy and milquetoast about it all that when you put it all together, the final piece is effectively a 5-minute advertisement about this man who claims to manipulate energy fields to halt people's addictions and addictive behaviors. And it goes even further than that. He's claimed, because I've read about other articles and features that have been done on the Mad Russian, he'll treat your obesity, your drug addiction, love sickness, he'll cure your love sickness, he will treat depression, he will try to help you with your hearing loss. If you have anorexia, you go to him, among many other claims, or at least people going to him with these sorts of ailments, and they feel that they have made an improvement in their life by his manipulation of bioenergy. Mm-hmm. Hey, that's...
Is that like different than like regular energy?
Yes, it's bioenergy, Kara.
Okay.
I found it really interesting that throughout the entire video, the only indication we get of his methodology is a shot of him wiggling his fingers at the camera like a haunted house actor, and then him asking a woman to remove her shirt at some point. That's all we get.
that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways and a lot of different things. This is classic gobbledygook. It is the kind of investigations that James Randi used to do about psychic healers, in which he would travel the world and among places, Russia, to investigate these healers who claim the exact same things that this particular gentleman in Massachusetts is claiming that he can do. Now, but what this guy has going for him is that he has treated some celebrities as well. Billy Joel swears by him. Drew Barrymore swears by him. Courtney Cox, among other celebrities.
But wait a minute. Yeah, celebrities can't be gullible, can they?
No, of course not. How could they be tricked into believing anything?
This is a modern-day Mesmer.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he is. He's treating animal magnetism, you know?
Yikes.
And there's very little follow-up. People may be able to walk out of there with some sort of change in their behavior of their addiction. But then you go to, where are they a month from now, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now? Have they really kick their addiction because of this? Have they used other techniques in the meantime to help them kick their addiction? How many of them actually didn't kick their addiction? How do you really know what's going on? There's no tracking. There's no scientific anything going on here. So for you to make these claims, and, you know, frankly, shame on NBC for giving this guy a platform.
Yeah, it's free advertising.
Yeah, is essentially what it is. But also, in a certain sense, I've looked for articles about skeptical organizations talking about this particular fellow, doing a debunking or an investigation or anything. We haven't. This guy has sort of slipped through the net in that sense, you know, since the 1980s.
There have been individuals who have done it, but, you know, there's no systematic study.
No systematic study. Certainly nothing that any organized skeptical group has done either, you know, amateurs or others that have gone and tried to do a real investigation as to what the fellow is claiming and what might really be going on there.
He's basically a naturopath. Right, that's what they do. They mix some very common sense, you know, nutritional advice with magic, you know?
It's exactly like magic. I mean, it's exactly the same as when a magician snaps their fingers when you've got a coin in your hand and says, "Did you feel something?" And almost everybody says yes and earnestly. And of course, nothing happened. I just asked them if they felt something and snapped my fingers. But I mean, that's as easy as it is.
Sure. Mm-hmm. One of the people in one of the other interviews I've seen with him, because there are a couple of recordings of this guy, you can go to YouTube and see. And one of the interviewers sat down with him, and he did his hocus pocus on her. And she said, "Oh, I felt something. I became warm. I became, you know, I could feel something happening inside my body." You know, I mean, it's just total psychological manipulation at that point. He said something was happening, and therefore the reporter thinks that something was happening. Is, you know, kind of quite obvious what was going on. But yeah, she seemed quite impressed by it, as do a bunch of other people. 167,000 people, apparently, who pay him $85 per session to go for his therapy.
Ugh, gosh.
Yeah, because the people where nothing happened, you know, don't end up on TV being interviewed.
Of course. You know what
I mean? They just go away and say, "Well, that was a waste." You know, you never hear from them again.
Yeah, it's like classic, what do you call it, confirmation bias. Right. Or that's not confirmation. Yeah, yeah, it is confirmation bias.
Well, it's selection bias.
Selection bias, where you're just like remembering the hits and not the misses.
Yeah.
So beware the Mad Russian.
Yeah.
So I think this actually can be tangentially related to the questions we were talking about at the beginning with free will. Just because there are interesting questions here about the chain of causality involved. You know, obviously there's some subjective sense of well-being that some people end up experiencing, but that has something to do with a suggestion that somebody's making, with the words they're saying, with their body language. And I think that trying to trace that line of causality is going to be really interesting. Can you trace that line of causality in terms of physics and A-level chemistry? Or are we going to have some sort of account where we can understand how something like an expectation can change something happening in your body? But of course, I have to say for Steve that, you know, the increases in well-being are in subjective experienced well-being and often not in actual measurable outcomes.
Yeah. Also, there's some non-specific just therapeutic relationship effects that happen. You know, people feel hope. They feel like they're getting – somebody's helping them, et cetera. That does not justify the magic, right?
Because
you can get that a real therapeutic relationship or, you know, real treatment. Even if there isn't anything physically or physiologically curative that you have, just having a professional, you know, therapeutic relationship is helpful.
Yeah. And I mean, at minimum, even if they suck at their job, at least they have like ethics training.
Yes. Yeah.
Like there's some sort of checks and balances.
And they're not going to convince you that magic is real, right? With all the downstream effects that has.
This fellow is selling the magic, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so unethical.
All right. Kara.
Yes.
This I actually blogged about this today, but this is because you sent me the item. There are a number of different ways in which scientists are trying to genetically engineer better photosynthesis.
Yeah, right. So we talk about this all the time on the show. We talk about the amount of arable land. We talk about the, you know, exploding population. And we talk about how are we going to feed all of the people, all the mouths that need to be fed on the planet with conventional farming technology as it is right now. Of course, the very strong argument that we make on the show is that genetic engineering is incredibly necessary, and there are a lot of really great outcomes if you know, the political will is there to be able to follow some of these really cool leads. And there's a new story that was published Actually, it was written in the Undark, which I think is a great outlet, by Aaron Zimmerman. And then, as you mentioned, you wrote a really brilliant blog post about it, about some new research that's come out within the last year regarding photosynthesis, specifically in bacteria. They really start with this conversation about the hot springs of Yellowstone National Park and how there are these thick mats of bacteria in these hot springs. And sort of at the surface, you've got these green organisms, these green bacteria that photosynthesize the way that we traditionally think of organisms as photosynthesizing. And then at the bottom, there are these algal mats that are like black, and there's no light that gets down there. And, you know, the idea has always been that those things didn't photosynthesize and they utilize some different process. And then, of course, it was found that not only do they photosynthesize, but they photosynthesize with the capability of actually making energy from near infrared light. And that light is heavily, heavily filtered. And the difference here is that they're actually using a completely different type of chlorophyll. So we've long known that there are different types of chlorophylls present within cells. Chlorophyll, remember, is the pigment that's found inside of a chloroplast. And it's that pigment which actually helps split water and then energized by light to develop these sugars that the plants or the cyanobacteria, the blue-green algae, actually consume, if you want to put it that way. And so we're often looking at things like chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B. We're often looking at carotenoids, these different types of pigments that we see in plants that give them a rich green or maybe orange color to their leaves. But this recent discovery has everything to do with chlorophyll F, and then chlorophyll D. So chlorophyll D actually carries out similar photosynthetic processes to the chlorophylls A and B, but for near infrared light. And it turns out it only exists in nature so far that scientists have discovered in a single genus of bacteria, which is really cool. Like, there's this one chlorophyll pigment that's only found in this one genus of bacteria that allows this bacterium to photosynthesize with heavily, heavily, heavily filtered light using the near infrared part of the spectrum. Chlorophyll F has been known for like a decade, but they didn't think that it actually was involved in the photosynthetic process of producing sugar until they were able to do some of these newer investigations. So the big, I think, change here and the big exciting kind of takeaway is that researchers who studied these pigments and who understood these photosynthetic processes didn't think that doing all the hard work to genetically engineer crops to be able to use more filtered light and grow in sort of a canopy system was necessarily going to be worth it, because they thought that fundamental to the natural variation of these plants and having these chlorophylls is that they're just not robust enough to be crop plants, that we wouldn't be able to grow them in a hardy way and feed a growing population, that we might have to use some sort of like canned light, maybe grow them in an indoor setting, like, you know, utilize the GM technology, but then that we would need all sorts of additional tools and technologies just to make them viable. But because they found this existing in situ, existing in nature, these researchers are now kind of changing their minds and saying, oh, crap, nature evolved this and it works. Like, we see a model of it working.
Yeah, it works in the real world. And when I was looking into this, Kara, because I'm fascinated with this whole topic, there's so many different ways in which researchers are working to improve photosynthesis. So this is one, you know, trying to take advantage of other frequencies of light, specifically the infrared frequencies. But there's also some plants have evolved a more efficient way of concentrating carbon.
And oh, cool.
That's the C4 pathway. Mm-hmm. Most crop plants use the C3 pathway, which is less efficient. So we're trying to get the C4 photosynthetic pathway from those plants that use it into our crop plants, which could in and of itself have like a 20% yield boost if we could do that. So, but we're trying to make C4 rice. You know, then that would be huge.
So this is that system in which there's like all these like in C3, there's all these byproducts that are produced, and it's actually like really takes up a lot of the energy of the organism.
That's a
whole other cool.
Yeah.
Trick
so there's
that
the
working
there,
okay.
Yeah. So there's sometimes the photosynthetic process, instead of combining the split water with carbon dioxide, it combines with oxygen. And that produces waste products, which it can then recoup But that going through that alternate pathway uses up a lot of energy. So mm-hmm. they're trying to, because they're just looking at different plants, have different enzyme systems. They're trying to get the more efficient, improve the efficiency, the catalytic efficiency of recuperating the wasted, you know, byproducts of photosynthesis. Then there's yet another way. Plants will, they have to shed waste heat when they get direct sunlight so they don't get burned. And so they have to turn off their photosynthesis and a little bit and get rid of the waste. And then when the cloud moves in front of the sun or whatever, then they have to turn the photosynthesis back on. Mm-hmm. And that's apparently slow. They can turn off photosynthesis very quickly, but they turn it back on only very slowly. And so that's a huge inefficiency. And so there are researchers who are working on ways to get the photosynthesis to turn back on more quickly when the plant is not at risk, you know, of getting sun damage.
Man, that's so cool. It's like, you know, it just reminds me of all the really cool stuff that's already been done in plant genomics. For example, like BT, it's just such a lifesaver, right? Let's take something that some plants automatically do, which is produce high levels of this chemical that is resistant to pests, and let's engineer it into plants that aren't very good at it.
Although BT is from bacteria.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. No, but there's BT toxin naturally occurring in plants.
But I'm not sure about that. I know the BT that we use for genetic engineering BT crops is from bacteria.
Damn it. I was almost positive that there was a BT toxin naturally occurring in a plant. But maybe it's an analog of that. But it is a similar idea.
But plants make lots of toxins. Most mm-hmm. pesticides you will ever consume come from plants that they make naturally for themselves, not added, you know, pesticides. We bred our crops to be fragile so that they don't have all the poisons that they usually use to protect themselves. Then we have to use artificial ones to protect them from, you know, pests because they're so vulnerable. We've made them, we've, you know, cultivated them to be so vulnerable.
Yeah, it's true. Most plants that are actually toxic to us are toxic to us because they're fighting pests.
Did we do that to make them more edible?
Yeah, because the toxins are bitter and they can make you sick.
And they can make you super sick if anybody saw Into the Wild.
Right. So we engineered them, we cultivated them to be more palatable to us, but that meant getting rid of their natural pesticides. So in any case, this is at least four separate ways to improve photosynthesis. This could significantly, up to like 60% or more, improve yield.
If we realize all of these things.
We need that.
Yeah, can you imagine growing crops like little forests instead of in these perfect little rows with all this space around them so that mm-hmm. they can get just the right amount of light that they need? Like think about layered farm beds.
That could be huge. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is funding a lot of this research.
They're killing it.
They are. I mean, you have to give them a shout out.
In order to do this research that's funded by Bill and Melinda Gates, the researchers have to make the technology publicly available to developing nations.
Yep. Steve, who's advising them? I mean,
they clearly know what they're doing. They are investing in key technologies.
Well, they have a lot of different science advisors. I actually had the opportunity to interview, what was his name, on my show, on Talk Nerdy, Jay Wegner, and he was their head of polio eradication efforts, and he was just like literally the most qualified person they could possibly have hired for the job.
Yeah,
and I think
awesome.
That's what they do across the board.
When you have billions of dollars, I want to hire the world expert in whatever.
It's like, oh, and we want to make the world so much better than it is right now. People are I'm kind of in on that.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. Or what's your goal? Our goal is to rid the world of polio. You know?
Yeah.
I want to vaccinate the world. You know, I want to feed the world. I mean, these are laudable goals. So, yeah, you have the resources and the vision to attract that kind of person. So they are, and they get shit for it from the conspiracy losers, right?
I know, it's so frustrating.
But, you know, it's going to take probably 20 years before any of these things are actually in the field.
Oh.
And mostly because of just regulations.
Yeah, just how slow it is to get everything approved.
Yeah. And which some of which is reasonable, but it's, I think it's mostly nonsense. Just, again, just fear mongering. And this is assuming that we ultimately have the political will. I see, I think the organic and the green lobby, I mean, they're nightmares that one of these things really hits, right? Because then it kind of breaks their narrative about, you know, demonizing GMOs. But, you know, we need it. We absolutely need it. Okay, Devin, you wanted to chat with us about how we know if stuff is real. Is that how that the approach is going to take?
Well, okay, stuff, my mind's about to be blown.
Stuff is real, isn't it?
Maybe.
Sounds like a philosopher question.
But I want to suggest, to you and your audience that there are two stories that came out this week that have relevance to the project of crafting a naturalistic metaphysics. Metaphysics? Yes, I'm going to bring up metaphysics on the SGU.
Cool. Take that back.
Well, I think that, well, the project of a naturalistic metaphysics, right? We first have to figure out what is that? What does a philosopher today mean by doing metaphysics? And I think that the best definition of that was given by Wilfred Sellers about 50 years ago. The idea is that we've got the world as revealed to us by science, the world of electrons and molecules and different kinds of particles and different unobservable entities. And then we've got the manifest world that we live in of tables and chairs and desks and desires and goals and dollars and economies and opportunities and home runs. And the idea is to sort of try to figure out how these are all part of the same physical reality. So some of the questions that surround that today involve, is matter best conceived of as decomposing into little self-same units, little things, or is that picture never really going to work if we're trying to be as accurate as possible in describing the nature of matter? So that's the distinction between what philosophers call a substance ontology and a process ontology. And I think most of us naturally, we think in terms of substances. The world is populated by things, and things interact with each other. And when we talk about causality at a level of physics, we're talking about things banging into each other, little things crashing into each other, and that's what causality reduces to. Well, I think that there are a number of results in modern particle physics and quantum mechanics that shed some doubt on this. And I'm not alone in the philosophical community, and there are some physicists who think this as well. So now the question is, what's my evidence? What are these stories that I'm saying that support the idea that maybe a substance ontology, the idea that we're ultimately going to explain the world in terms of little self-same entities that persist over time, isn't going to work? First of all, we've got a new study that was published this week in China in a journal called China Science and Physics from Shaanxi University. And they were able to use mathematics to confirm many aspects of Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem, you guys have discussed on the show before. This is the whole idea that you're never going to explain quantum behaviors in terms of local hidden variables. That there's no story you can tell about what the particle is really doing on a local level that's going to account for the behaviors we see in quantum systems. So this has been experimentally verified a few times. This new study was mathematically verifying it. But what they also showed was something that I think is often overlooked in this discussion, which is that although Bell's theorem rules out local hidden variables, it doesn't rule out the idea of non-local hidden variables. So what is a non-local hidden variable? Well, here's where the suggestion of process ontology comes in. And this is where I'm just sort of trying to plant an idea in your minds and you can do with it what you think. Is it possible that a completed physics will have to do away with the idea that there are fixed entities like electrons and protons and positrons and sort of decompose these into very convenient labels that we're putting onto what are actually very transient, constantly changing processes? So this relates back to the story about the moons earlier. But yeah, Kara?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, kind of the way that Sean Carroll described one time in a talk, trying to understand the Higgs field and that sort of understanding the Higgs boson as a particle is actually a very complicated way to think about it. And it confuses the concept.
Yeah.
And that the more that you think of it as a field and less that you think of it as an actual physical particle, the sort of more all of this physics around it starts to make a lot of sense.
Right. And that's not just for the Higgs boson, but every fundamental particle can be is ultimately a field, and fields that are interacting, and we call them these discrete particles, but they're actually these fields. And so yeah, so that's definitely related. I was thinking, you read my mind, Kara. Definitely.
Oh, that's funny.
Thinking about that. Yep.
Yeah, and so there was another study that was published just today that shows this new potential for doubly excited electrons. They're calling it. They're taking positrons. And then they are they're basically charging them up with a lot of energy using lasers to put them in a state called D-wave resonance. And without going into too much detail, basically the idea is they're taking these positrons, they're pumping a lot of energy into them, and then they're saying it changes it into a different thing with different properties. And this is the kind of story that I read in physics journals that makes me say, what would this story look like if we had a more coherent way of talking about physics, where we just do away with this particle talk and we talk about what's going on with these fluctuating values and fields? You guys had a story a couple of weeks ago about excitons on the show, and you were talking about how excitons give off another particle that sort of transiently exists for a few fractions of a second and then is annihilated again. And these are the kinds of stories that I think could become potentially a lot less strange if we figured out how to talk exclusively in terms of values and fields and sort of take seriously the idea that talking in terms of particles is probably not metaphysically accurate.
So that said, are you saying that everything is a field and particles, we shouldn't think of things in the idea of particles anymore?
We're never going to be able to totally get rid of particle talk. It's too useful. We need to be able to label things and be able to talk about them in terms of something that stays the same throughout time, even if we appreciate that they're mercurial when we're trying to nail it down really specifically. Yeah, so I think that there are a number of problems that arise in contemporary metaphysics, like the question, how could something like my desire have any kind of causal influence? Or, how is it that the words that I'm speaking could affect your synaptic wiring? I think that that's where we run into problems when we try to conceive of everything that exists in terms of discrete units that are sort of able to be separated from each other. One of the ideas of process ontology is that not only are there maybe no fundamental unitary elements at the bottom level, but when you look at the rest of the levels as well, you alluded to selves earlier in the show. We talked about these moon-like objects in the Lagrange points. When you think about objects on our day-to-day scale, they're all sort of semi-stable configurations as well. None of them are going to last forever. And so I'm interested by what's going to happen to theories of causality, especially concerning how we knit together these different levels of organization, if we start to think more in terms of process being prior to substance.
To bring it back to my news item, is that we are kind of locked in a way into our physical thinking, and we have to break out of that to some extent. So maybe like we need to extend the metaphor further, right? We're using these sort of metaphors of particles to explain quantum phenomena that are not inherently particles, but that's how we understand the world. And so now we're trying to increase our repertoire of ideas, which is always the hardest thing to do, to sort of stretch those metaphors further, or maybe just break out of them. Like it's useful to understand the world for us with
Absolutely.
Our monkey brains to understand the world, but then they also constrain how we think about the world.
I think we may have to ultimately face the possibility that we will never be able to fully grasp, the ultimate fundamental nature of the universe. I mean, try to think of, look at a magnetic field. I mean, magnetism, that's like magic That's like the like natural magic in
that's
nature.
That's what I always
if you,
say.
If you think about
man,
it.
How do they work?
there's a lot in physics, you know, kinetic energy and impacts and things like that you understand. But magnetism is always like,
it's
what?
It's kind of spooky. I think when you get down to the four fundamental forces is where you reach where investigation comes to an end for right now and where explanation comes to an end.
Right, and we may never be able to fully grasp it until we like can augment our minds and, you know, trying to teach a dog algebra, you know, a regular dog's never going to grasp it unless you uplift them in some way.
But we've got to try. Somebody's got to be the dog trying to grasp algebra, and that's why.
Absolutely.
That's why this is a job still today for both theoretical physicists and philosophers, because it is we're at the level right now of dogs trying to understand algebra. And so we need as much help as we can get. And we absolutely need the experimentalists. We need the theoretical physicists. But there's also a lot of exciting work being done in trying to figure out how we could reconfigure, talk about the fundamental nature of reality in terms of structure rather than substance. And that's a project I'm engaged in for better or worse.
And I think it's really cool. And it's also an area where let's not forget about the strong parallel between, you know, we talk often about turning our viewpoints and our perspectives outward to understand the cosmos as a whole. But we don't often take the time to talk about turning that perspective and that viewpoint inward to understand mental processes. And, you know, again, like we have a relatively good neurobiological grasp on what's going on inside of somebody's mind, the same way that we have a relatively good physical grasp of what's going on out there in the cosmos. But a lot of these concepts, things like feelings, these, you know, these like core cognitive and affective concepts are very difficult to describe verbally, physiologically.
Yes.
You know, yeah, what is a feeling? Like, what is anger?
Yeah. We don't have the language.
Vertical. It's not a thing. It's just it's an occurrence.
And this is also where, you know, I think phenomenology does a really good job at its best of supplementing psychology. Phenomena.
I had that too, Jay.
But yeah, I mean, I think it can do a good job of supplementing psychology, of supplementing neuroscience in order to try to get some kind of purchase on these questions, because I'm not a believer in the hard problem of consciousness. I think ultimately, you know, neuroscience, scientific methods, phenomenology, philosophy, we're going to crack this nut. But I do think that there's a lot that we have to try to figure out how we're going to cash it out in naturalistic terms. And I think that it may be the case that we don't have to cash out causality within the nervous system and the organism totally in terms of bottom up particles banging into each other, micro bangings. I could be wrong.
Yeah, and don't forget, there's a lot of the big questions we have about the universe and time, entropy. A lot of big questions are going to ultimately, we really can only speculate until we do some fundamental things, like say, you know, unify quantum mechanics and relativity, get quantum gravity, will answer a lot of questions. And that's something that I think is within our grasp and something that we may see in a lot of our lifetimes. But a lot of big questions will be answered once we can figure that shit out.
But I think the dog analogy breaks down because there's fundamental difference between the way humans approach knowledge and the way dogs approach knowledge. The dogs aren't on a path to greater knowledge.
They're not cybernetic.
They're not cybernetic. And the other thing is, Bob, and you're going to agree with this, is that if we can't figure something out, we'll make an AI.
And also, no matter how much something contradicts our intuitions, we're capable of figuring out stuff that's wildly counterintuitive. I mean, eventually figured out that Euclidean geometry was not metaphysically correct.
And Steve, you're crazy. Dude, I mean, that's ridiculous, Steve. You really think that a human being can comprehend anything in the universe? Anything that could exist in the universe?
I don't think he said that.
I did not say that. The dog analogy.
But that's what
down.
You're implying. That's what you're implying, that if we can't figure something out, then we'll just have our computer tell us what it is.
I think that was a joke. Well,
I didn't take it. Well, you don't joke about this shit, Steve.
The point is,
this is serious stuff.
I'm serious because it's recursive. Because we could make something smarter that can make something smarter that can make something smarter. So if something is capable of being understood, we may be on the pathway to understanding.
Yes, but you're making my point. You're making my point. You're making something smarter and smarter to understand something. So that pinnacle, that, you know, heightened intelligence, that augmented computer intelligence, will understand it, and it'll give us the kindergarten
view to us.
of that topic. But it will understand.
We'll be able to understand it.
It will understand
at
it because
some
it's
level.
Smarter than we are. Smarter than we, a baseline human, can be.
Basically,
thank you.
Because of this,
there's nothing. Because it's fundamental about the universe. There's not a fundamental line in the sand, we're saying, that defines what's knowable and what's not. There was no superpower that drew a line.
Fundamental lines are hard to come by. There aren't a whole lot of fundamental lines anywhere. There's no fundamental line between life and non-life, consciousness and non-consciousness.
Yeah, it's the demarcation problem. Plus, you have to define understanding a system. You know, we can get back to the weather analogy. I could understand all the components that go into the weather without being able to predict what the weather is going to be like in a month. And it's the same thing with the human brain. We could understand how all the pieces work. That doesn't mean that we're going to fully be able to describe the complexity of even a single mind. Because it's way too
there's
complex.
Also, and you might agree with me here, Steve, I think there's a natural kind of psychological dualism that stands in the way. I think that people, no matter how much you can describe how a certain kind of subjective experience is being realized by physical processes, there's always a kind of perceived gap. People are like, yeah, but how does that become my experience? And I feel like people will always be asking that question even once we've explained it exhaustively.
I think that's because our brain evolved, you know, vertebrate brains evolved to create the illusion of consciousness. And so it's almost like the brain works in a way to keep you from understanding the illusion of consciousness, right? We can't really imagine how our stream of consciousness is the result of a physical process, because
its own tracks.
We're evolved not to understand that, because of really being able to understand it would break the illusion we need to function.
I would just say that I don't like to call it illusion, just because, I mean, there's a sense in which it's an illusion, right? Because there is this appearance of a single unitary thing coming out of something that's more like a termite colony than a single.
It's a perception.
But it's still that perception of an enduring you. That is a real thing. There's a sense in which it's being constructed daily by your brain, and it's not nearly as unitary or stable as you think it is.
It's more like the moon cloud.
Exactly. Brought it all the way back.
So now we've tied everything together. We've tied everything. All of our news items relate to each other in some way. So I think that's a good place to stop and move on with Who's That Noisy?
Well, Steve, last week I played this noisy. Seriously, that is all the same animal.
It's an adorable baby raptor.
Exactly. Right.
There were frogs
exactly.
and birds.
Yeah, there were frogs at the beginning.
Going.
Yeah, I don't know. What the heck?
I know. That's why this one is so good. So Marcus Noble wrote in and said, "Ha ha, I was completely sure on my previous guesses. This week's guess, the Tasmanian devil." Mm. Not a bad guess. I did listen to noises that a Tasmanian devil makes. One of those five noises sounds a little bit similar, but nope, Marcus, that is not a Tasmanian devil. Another listener named Klerner D27 said, "Yo, Jay, here's my fourth ever guess at a noisy. It's a caribou. I imagine it huffing and snortling ever so majestically in the woods."
Snortling?
Oh, caribou.
Yes.
I love snortle. That's the best word ever. Also, caribou is my nickname for my best friend, Kelly. She calls me caribou.
I will remember that.
Ah, clever.
Unfortunately, it is not a caribou. Jim Kelly said, "Hi, is this week's noisy a Komodo dragon?" No, Komodo dragons do not make those noises. Not a Komodo dragon. They're bad, though. Bad news, man. If you ever see one of them and it's not behind, you know, a cage wall or something, run away, because they can kill you.
Oh, yeah. Isn't it saliva have a bacteria that will infect your blood?
Ew.
Yeah, they're really dangerous.
You'll go
near those bacteria.
You'll go into sepsis.
By the way, the Komodo dragon thing with the bacteria is a little, is not that clear.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, but they are dangerous animals.
Absolutely. They're the largest lizard. They will kill you.
Oh, they'll tell you. They'll tell you apart.
But the whole idea that that their mouth is particularly dirty is actually more of a myth.
Ooh. So good to know.
Brett Fisher was the first person to write in about this week's noisy being a lyrebird. Lots of people wrote in. It isn't a lyrebird, but here's the problem. Because lyrebirds can set it could be, right? They sound like they can sound like, you know, a camera clicking and a chainsaw, so they could probably sound like whatever this animal is. But this particular recording was not taken from a lyrebird. And that will never be an okay answer on who's that noisy ever again. But thank you for, of course, sending the emails in. So the winner. Now, this person, Michelle Cannon, like wrote in at 5:37 today, like right under the, you know, right before I closed the gate on who's that noisy. And she guessed correctly. She's the winner this week. That noisy made me remember the sound of a cassowary I looked up once. That is a cassowary. So what is a cassowary?
It's a boy.
A cassowary. It's a big
bird. It's a dinosaur.
It is like a friggin' raptor.
It is a dinosaur. I was so happy you said that. It is a dinosaur. You know, they have a little bit of an ostrich-looking head, but these birds make dinosaur freaking noises.
But they have like dinosaurian-looking faces too, right? Don't they have those like blue things that are kind of hangy? They're quite bright compared to...
They don't look friendly.
No, they have like the turkey neck hanging thing and these like big crests on their heads, and they're very colorful, you know, which usually is a signal in the wild, like, get away.
And if I'm not mistaken, they'll gore you with a claw in the same way a raptor would have.
Wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, they're not the friendliest, I'll tell you that. And here's another thing. If you just imagine when you look at the video of one, if you take a look at a video, just say, okay, instead of it being, you know, 6 feet, seven, maybe 8 feet tall, imagine it's 15 feet tall and it's muscular.
And give it teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And give it bigger teeth, and that's a dinosaur.
Well, teeth. Doesn't have any teeth.
Yeah, it's a bird.
Give it teeth.
Give it teeth, and it becomes a dinosaur, yeah. Yeah. Ooh, look at this. They are strong and big and graceful enough. I'm reading a Scientific American blog about cassowaries. To jump and forcibly kick a grown man in his chest.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yep, you don't want that happening.
That's like a cool like ninja move that they do.
Once they get you down, you're dead. You know what I'm saying? Okay, so this week's noisy. This is a new noisy for this week. This one was sent in by none other than Ian Callanan.
Oh, Ian.
Who's that?
Ian.
Oh, right. Yeah,
yay,
of course.
Ian.
So Ian and I have become very good friends, and I'll tell you what happened in the email next week, where he actually embarrassed me a little bit in my own email thread. Anyway, Ian sent in this noisy. Very cool. Very cool noisy. If you think you know what it is, or if you've heard something cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Well, it's time for science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then you have to tell me which one is the fake. Devin, are you ready for your first science or fiction?
Oh, boy. I'm ready.
Oh, boy. There's a theme. There's a theme for this one. So this episode is the last episode to air prior to Thanksgiving.
Yep.
So this is our Thanksgiving episode. The theme is not Thanksgiving, though, Jay.
Oh, okay. Come on.
Because I did that already.
Jay, done that.
I did.
Yeah, but there's lots of Thanksgiving trivia.
American Indians, and I've done American history. I've done a lot of things around this, but I'm just going to do – this one is going to be on myths about colonial America.
Okay.
Oh, all right, that's cool. Oh, boy. History. I'm not great at history. Yeah.
Me neither.
So two of these are all facts about colonial America. – Two of them are real and one is fictitious. Here we go. Item number one. In the 17th century, 40% of children failed to live to adulthood. Item number two. Estimates of literacy in the 18th century New England are from 90 to 100% for men and 31 to 48% for women. Oof. And item number three, beds were shorter than the modern standard, reflecting the generally shorter stature that was typical of the time. All right. Well, Devin, as our guest, you get the honor of going first.
Oh, boy. The honor.
Well, let me think. I'm going to take these in reverse order, I think. Number three, beds were shorter than the modern standard, reflecting the generally shorter stature that was typical of the time. Well, I do believe that that was true. I myself am only 5 feet tall, not a hair taller. So this height is something that I've looked into throughout my life. And I do believe recalling that people have only gotten significantly taller within relatively recent history. And a lot of it is due to nutrition, they think. But I'm not sure about that. But that seems to me like that would probably be true, especially since it says just shorter and generally shorter. That seems safe. Number two, estimates of literacy in the 18th century New England are from 90 to 100% for men and 31 to 48% for women. Well, I want to say that both of these statistics sound too high to me. I believe that the spread would have been similar to that. Obviously, in that time, men were being educated radically differently from women, and women were often not taught to read, even in families or classes where the men would have been taught to read. Nevertheless, New England in the 18th century, 90 to 100% for men, just that seems so high. I want to say that both of those numbers might be lower. But then the first item is also that in the 17th century, 40% of children failed to live to adulthood, which is an enormously high number. I know infant mortality rates were much higher in the past, and that has a lot to do with the increasing average lifespan. I'm going to go ahead and say that 90 to 100% of men were not literate in 18th century New England. Number two has got to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Good job. I had similar thinking on these. The shorter beds, I'm not as confident as you were, Devin, but I still kind of agree. And the other for the one, number one and two, the other ones with the children and the literacy, I agree. Both those number, all those numbers seem high. Let's see. 40% of children fail to reach adulthood. I mean, yeah, that's just, wow. 4 out of 10, 2 out of 5. Well, when you put it that way. Okay. Yeah, that just makes it my feeling even stronger, that number two, the literacy rate. Yeah, 90 to 100%. The spread, like Devin said, the spread's good, but I think both numbers were like doubled or something. So I'm going to say that the literacy one is fiction as well.
Okay, Kara.
GWD.
So you're talking about white men, right? White men in New England.
Yes.
What does that matter?
No, it's true.
It totally matters.
That's
black
totally
men did
true.
Not illiterate.
That's a good
yeah,
totally
but that's partly
a
why.
That's a racist statement, Kara.
No, it's a reflection of the racist history of our country.
You are
actually.
So racist. Wow.
Jay, go to her.
Go to her
Twitter feed.
Twitter feed
exactly.
Right now. Like crazy.
So,
I don't even know if I know you anymore.
But I do think that's important, and I think that in this
Kara is correct. That statistics applies to white people.
Yeah, yeah. And New England obviously there was slavery still early on, but obviously
not at that time.
Yeah, not in that era.
Not in New England. Not in that not in New England.
Region. So the thing that strikes me about the literacy question, that is the one that everybody else has chosen so far, is the big shift between men and women, which I believe to be true. I think that there were literate women, and I think that those literate women were likely the teachers within the communities, but I think that there were at least double the literacy rate for men than for women. And I'm not surprised. 90 to 100%, I know it seems high, but I'm also trying to think of the people who came, like the early colonialists who came to America, came often for ideological reasons, for political reasons, for
yeah,
reasons
I'm worried
to
about
find
that.
A new future. And so, yeah, I'm thinking that probably these were actually educated, by and large, more educated individuals, and that there were schools set up, of course, and things like that. I totally also am buying what you're selling about the beds. I've definitely toured like old places. I don't know if I've been to a 1700s home that was restored, but I've definitely been to, you know, places that were, you know, sort of time capsules from centuries ago, and everything seemed smaller. And I was like, even I was almost bumping my head on the doorways and stuff. So that doesn't surprise me. So the last question for me is the 40% of children failing to live to adulthood. And to me, I'm going to be honest, that seems high. Infant mortality of almost half just 3 centuries ago. Like,
this is, remember, this is failed to live to adulthood. This is not all infant mortality.
Oh, it's not infant mortality. You're right. But
it's all childhood mortality.
Okay. I think that most childhood mortality does cluster toward infant mortality, but you're right. But I don't think like child mortality would have been nearly half. That's to me insane. Like that's representative of like a Spanish flu situation. So I'm gonna say that that's actually the fiction.
All right, Evan.
Okay, so beds shorter than modern standard. Yes, they were, and I think it was due to the fact they were generally shorter. The literacy one, 18th century, 90 to 100%. Yeah, and it's. Certainly people came here well-educated from Europe, and you were already into what, in some cases, fourth, fifth, and sixth generation New Englanders, I think, by that time. So they had established their churches everywhere, schools among them closely tied to the churches, and that influence so strong in New England. Yeah, I think that one's going to turn out to actually be science. Which leaves me with 40% of children failed to live to adulthood. That one with Kara is the fiction.
All right, Jay, so we have an even split. You get to break the tie.
Jay, go with the other one. Let's sweep Steve.
don't give him the satisfaction.
Yeah. Quickly, the first one here about the 40% of children failed to live to adulthood. I mean, I don't know. That didn't surprise me at all. I think that's accurate. Next one here, estimates of literacy in the 18th century. This one makes perfect sense to me. 90 to 100% of men were literate and 31 to 48% of women were literate. Or 31 to 48. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And this one about the beds being shorter, I had some observations while touring the UK that I made. And I observed that things weren't as small as I expected them to be. I thought we were going to be walking into pubs and everything was going to be kind of like on the shorter scale. Nothing was like that. And I just don't think that people were that much shorter 250, 300 years ago. I don't think that beds were smaller. I really don't. And also, wow. Have you ever looked at antique bed frames?
Probably. They're not
antique?
They're not smaller. I've been to colonial houses. I've seen bed frames from colonial times. And if anything, you know, the beds seem to be higher and they seem to have way more stuffing in them. But I don't think that they were shorter. So I think that this is the one that Steve thinks that we all would just be like, oh, of course, because everybody was smaller and shorter and dumber back then.
But Crap.
I don't agree. I don't agree at all.
I'll lose all my short dude cred forever.
That's right.
All right, so you guys are all spread out, so I guess I could just take these in order. In the 17th century, 40% of children failed to live to adulthood. Evan and Kara think this one is the fiction, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this one is science.
Shit. Oh, no, Evan.
That, yes, 40%. And it was all infection. It was that was like the big killer. You know, it was just... Yeah, just they just would get plague after plague, you know. It was just hard to get through your childhood without catching something, you know. And there was no antibiotics. There was no real, you know, the modern medical care. I mean,
how about cleanliness? They didn't even really understand.
There was no germ theory.
They didn't know how to treat infection.
They didn't know how to prevent the spread. I mean, at some point they realized that, you know. I mean, this is the point where they thought that was the miasms or whatever, you know, from the vapors, you know, that were causing
the vapors. Oh, I'll get the you vapors. Every time.
And it's coming in the future, guys. We're going to have no antibiotics, so it'll happen again.
Yeah, but it won't be that bad because, like, because they didn't even have basic medical.
Yeah, we at
care,
least have like septic technique and stuff.
Yeah, we can intubate 80% of our kids.
Yeah,
yeah, we're good.
That's terrible.
All right, let's go on to number two. Estimates of literacy in 18th century New England are from 90 to 100% for men and 31 to 80%, 48% for women. Bob and Devin, you think this one is the fiction. Jay is still alive. He thinks this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
Science.
You bastard.
Nice solo win for Jay.
Delicious. Oh, it's like drinking their tears.
Oh, my God. Does this mean I'm tall? Am I not short anymore?
So here's the thing. Jay, you got it exactly right. Almost exactly right. There's a little tweak there. But in colonial America, people were not that much shorter than modern times, first of all. A good census from 1776 found that men averaged height 5.8. That's only 1 inch shorter than today, 5.9. Now, and they were 3 inches taller than their European counterparts. So the idea of the short, you know, that people were shorter back then is true in Europe, just wasn't true, that as much true in the Americas, in the colonies. People were better fed in the colonies. Mm-hmm. So I guess we had access to a lot of food.
You hear the thing about like the children in China like weren't fitting in the desks because the generation before, and I think that's true because it was all about nutrition. They just were not getting proper nutrition. Then like the next generation was eating correctly. And
also keep in mind,
normal size.
4 out of 5 people lived on a farm at that time.
Okay.
You know,
that's helpful.
We weren't packed into London or big cities. You know what I mean?
And I mean, they're still shorter by a few inches on average in Europe. And when you're 5 feet tall, you notice that sort of thing.
In some parts of Europe, not in Northern Europe.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Not in Northern Europe, but I mean, more tall. Spain, Italy, little bit shorter in France.
And Jay's also right. Beds were not shorter. There was no specific size. Beds were custom made, and surveys of beds from those times shows that they were, if anything, a little bit bigger. But there's an optical illusion because they were so fluffy and they had high posts. It makes them look shorter to our eye, but if you measure them, they actually were not shorter on average. So they were fine.
You know that look of like a bed from the 1700s where it has almost a rounded top look to it? I always wanted to just dive into one of those.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so funny because as I'm imagining this news item when you first read it, like I'm imagining, Jay, were you seeing like a big, beautifully ornate carved four-poster bed?
Yeah, in that's right.
I was seeing a bed in a tuberculosis ward. I was seeing like one of those white metal.
Yeah, pre-coffins.
Kara, it all comes back to you not enjoying food the right way.
All right. Now,
but that's Devin the little tiny bed I was imagining the whole time during this news item. That's
Devin
so funny.
Devin and I were like, our 17th century bed was gorgeous.
Mine was literally where you die.
But let's go back to number two about the estimates of literacy in the 18th century.
Is so this like in Boston or what?
Well, all right, Boston, you bring up Boston. Boston had approached 100%. That's where the 100% comes from.
Wow.
But even in, you know, more suburban New England, it was, you know, 90% or more for men. Women were less. And that's because, women were not as encouraged to get schooling or to read, of course. There was in the colonies, culturally, there was a huge value put on literacy and knowledge and reading. And so it was every man was expected to be literate, you know, basically.
We did that now.
How could you read your Bible if you weren't?
Well, I mean, it wasn't just that. This is the age of the Enlightenment too, Evan. I mean, the colonies were not that, you know, backwater, you know, as sort of the image as you think.
No, but also Enlightenment era people read the Bible.
I'm not saying that, Steve. It's not a modern comparison.
That is it.
You went to your school was your church, and your church was your school. They just were intertwined at the time.
That's partly true, but it was also dedicated to just knowledge. It wasn't just so you could read the Bible. I don't want you to create a false impression there. There was a respect for knowledge itself. There was definitely respected in the culture, and literacy rates were fairly high. So for white men approaching modern levels, right? Less so for black individuals and less so for women.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. Because there was an actual social push.
It was all culture. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Make
the bed one, yeah, that, the yeah, bed exactly. one was the gotcha one. Because I thought, because that's a common myth. And it's there's multiple layers there. The idea that you think people are shorter, but it's really only true in Europe, not so much. And also the optical illusion of the way the beds looked.
Yeah.
Because I've been to these old homes, and they do look short. But it
I
is
can't believe child mortality was that high.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I thought that was the easy one. 40%. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's why I thought it was a fiction.
I mean, just every colonial historical figure you know of, all their children are dead, right? I mean, they.
That's so true.
Go to a graveyard. Well, you know, in Connecticut, you can go to graveyards that are literally from the 1700s and look at the ages. Yeah, the ages tell the story, man. A lot of people died less than 20. A lot of children in those graveyards.
A lot of ghosts.
Sad. Jeez, very sad. Steve. Yeah. It's
bummer.
True.
And Devin, I'd like to tell you something. I'm going to give you something to be happy about.
What's that, Jay?
Without a doubt, you're going to live longer than taller people.
is that true?
Yeah,
it's true. Really tall people.
Yeah.
Well, then very tall people.
Then very tall people.
Your cardiovascular system is going to last longer. That's it.
Think about it.
I wouldn't say without a doubt. I don't want you to get, start jumping off mountains.
I'm never going
to
exercise again.
Sticks of butter.
it's like dogs. You know, how often have you seen little old men compared to tall old men? You know, typically the overwhelming majority is like little old men.
if I can live as long as Randy has lived so far, I will be a very happy man.
Yeah. Right?
90. Right? Age 90.
Aw.
So shorter and lighter people live longer than taller or heavier. And part of it, one of the theories is it's just about how many cells there are in your body.
Interesting.
The bigger you are, the more cells you have, the more likely you are to get cancer, the more likely there is for stuff to go wrong. So it may not be necessarily the cardiovascular system. That seems like an obvious answer, but it could be just you have more cells.
Diet starts tomorrow.
Yeah. I remember.
I weigh 105 pounds.
Well, yeah. Oh, man. You will you will know all of us dead.
Oh, my gosh. And
I'm
included
read all
in
of
that.
Our gravestones.
I want to go on your diet.
So that was a fun one. I like that one.
Yeah.
Me too. I love it.
Except for the result. I like the
result. The result was beautiful.
You got me so good.
You did fine. You reasoned very well through all of the items. You fell predictably into pattern. You know what I was hoping for. So don't worry about it. And you learned something, right? Which is the only thing that matters.
Don't feel bad.
Done.
George has tried dozens of times. I think he's only got one correct out of
that's the most recent time.
20 shows or something.
I'm not sure if I do any better than Chance playing at home, but we'll see.
Well, hey, Devin, thanks for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me. It's been an amazing experience. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Great job, Devin.
Thank you for your support. We really appreciate the support, by the way.
Hell yeah.
Absolutely. And I hope to keep in touch with you guys and maybe see you at a skeptical conference at some point.
Absolutely.
That'd be great.
And happy Thanksgiving to all of our American listeners.
Happy Thanksgiving.
And that's the one day of the year that you just overeat. Just do it. You're going to do it anyway. Enjoy it. Don't worry about it. Just eat what you want to eat. Okay, Evan, you're going to give us a quote, and you're going to do it in the appropriate voice.
Oh, boy.
There we go, love.
I'm putting myself to the fullest possible use, which is all I think any conscious entity can ever hope to do.
HAL 9000, folks.
That is nicely done.
Iconic. Yes. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks again, Devin. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.